Usually, when we think about studying human culture, there's this expectation of distance, like archaeology, right?
Right, yeah, like it's categorized and safe.
Exactly. You carefully brush the dirt off a clay pot, you put it behind a pane of glass in a quiet museum, and the curator points to it and says, this is who they were.
It's completely sterilized for your protection.
Yeah. But then you decide to study the raw, unfiltered underbelly of internet culture, and suddenly you aren't in a museum anymore.
No, not at all.
You've like stepped out the back door, prod open a manhole cover, and just drop straight into a rushing, chaotic sewer of raw human thought. It's messy, it's loud, and honestly, it can be pretty shocking.
It is the absolute definition of information overload. I mean, we are talking about a space with no editor, no social filters, and total anonymity.
Right. So for you listening right now, consider this your protective hazmat suit, because today's deep dive takes us directly into the void. Our source material today is a massive, completely anonymous image board thread.
Yeah, specifically from a board called /MCD/.
Right, and let me tell you, it is a fire hose. If you were to just scroll through this text, you would get hyper-detailed video game critiques smashing right up against intense geopolitical ramps.
Which is jarring enough on its own.
Totally. And then out of nowhere, you hit these incredibly stark, deeply personal confessions of depression.
And, our mission for this deep dive is to essentially act as your filter. We are going to sift through this wall of anonymous internet noise and extract the underlying themes.
Yeah, we want to map out exactly how this specific subculture dissects modern media, right?
Exactly. How they grapple with a very painful sense of nostalgia, and ultimately how they use extreme anonymity as a coping mechanism for modern loneliness.
So I want to start with the media dissection, because to understand who these anonymous users are, we have to look at what they spend the vast majority of their time actually doing on this board.
Which is ruthlessly, almost surgically, tearing apart popular media.
Yes. And I mean specifically indie video games. But they aren't just saying, like, oh, I didn't like the jump mechanics. They harbor this intense, hyper-specific resentment toward the developers themselves.
It's a very particular kind of microscopic criticism. They view the creators of these games not as artists, but almost as hostile entities.
Right. Like, there's this one developer they refer to as Fobbytox, which is clearly a filtered nickname the board uses.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
And they are furious that his quote-unquote small game project has taken 10 years to develop. But the anger isn't just about the wait time. They are dissecting the writing on a molecular level.
Oh, absolutely.
He complained about his reliance on repetitive dialogue quirks. They even use this highly offensive, racist internet slang term, wiggerisms, to describe it.
Yeah, we should probably pause and decode that term because it tells you a lot about their mindset.
Please do.
In the context of this board, they've repurposed that slur to act as shorthand. For dialogue they view as artificially edgy or culturally appropriative or, just trying entirely too hard to mimic an aesthetic that isn't authentic to the creator.
Wow.
Yeah, it's basically an aggressive way of calling the developer a fraud.
And they also tear into how this developer forces emotional impact. Like, they point out his habit of having characters stutter in the text, like
Yeah.
writing the letter I dash the letter I to manufacture this profound, vulnerable moment.
Right, and what is happening there is a rejection of forced empathy.
How so?
Well, when a game takes 10 years to develop, a highly invested, highly isolated internet user develops a deeply parasocial relationship with the project.
That makes sense.
The wait becomes a sunk cost. Every single update is scrutinized. So by the time the game actually comes out, they aren't looking to enjoy it, they are looking to punish it for the time they spent waiting.
Right, like they're owed something.
Exactly. So when a character stutters on screen to elicit sympathy, these users don't see a sad character. They see the developer's hand reaching through the screen, trying to manipulate their emotions.
Oh, wow. They even debate his production methods, too.
Yeah.
There's a whole section where they argue over whether this developer is lying about localizing the game himself into Japanese.
Yeah, they claim it's just a manufactured engagement bait tactic to get attention online.
Right. Every single action is viewed through this lens of extreme bad faith.
It's the assumption of absolute narcissism. Because they feel powerless and unseen, they assume anyone who does have a platform or an audience must be using it maliciously.
And it doesn't stop with that one game either.
Yeah.
They bring up a title called Mina the Hollower, and the critique is so remarkably specific. They complain the protagonist has this forced girl boss writing, that she lacks any actual charm, and just act perpetually agitated.
Right.
They feel like the character only exists to forcefully remind the player that the game world is grim dark, rather than just letting the world speak for itself.
And that perfectly leads into the even deeper vitriol they reserve for what they call art games.
Oh, the hatred for art games is palpable. There's a game mentioned in the text called Anthology of the Killer. The board completely dismisses it as self-indulgent hipster yarn ball.
Hipster yarn ball.
Yeah. One user describes the writing as prolix, just overly wordy and pretentious. Another user literally says playing it made them feel catatonic and absolutely drained of life.
Because they view these art games as heavy-handed anti-capitalist messaging created by wealthy, out-of-touch creators.
Right.
They resent the perceived social capital of the developer more than they care about the game mechanics themselves. They feel they are being lectured to by people who have easier lives than they do.
You know, I was reading this section, and I kept trying to visualize what this behavior actually looks like in practice. It's like watching someone analyze a beautiful painting of the ocean, but instead of stepping back to look at the water, they take out a microscope.
Mm.
And they just angrily complain about the chemical composition of the blue paint. They completely ignore the art to hunt for proof that the painter used cheap materials.
That is exactly the mechanism at play. Using the microscope protects them.
Protects them.
Yeah, if you step back and just look at the painting of the ocean, you have to engage with it emotionally. You might actually feel something.
Oh, I see.
But if you focus entirely on the chemical composition of the paint, you maintain total intellectual control. You can't be emotionally manipulated by the ocean if you're busy proving the painter is a fraud.
That makes me wonder, though, is this extreme nitpicking actually born out of a genuine feeling of being betrayed by, like, long development cycles and heavy-handed writing? Or is tearing things down just the default currency for getting clout in an anonymous internet space?
Well, think about it. In an anonymous space, you don't have an identity, a job title, or a face to leverage for respect. You only have your intellect. And the easiest, fastest way to demonstrate intellect in a cynical space is by being the harshest, most perceptive critic. You prove you are smart by proving how something else is fundamentally stupid.
But you can only hate so many modern, polished indie games before you have to ask yourself, you know, what do these people actually consider good? What do they actually like?
And looking at the text, the answer isn't a specific type of game.
No, it's a specific era. They have this deep, almost painful nostalgia for the unpolished, clumsy days of early gaming.
They are actively mourning the death of the old Electronic Entertainment Expo, the E3 days.
The E3 nostalgia is so vivid in this thread. They look at modern award shows like the Summer Game Fest, and they just see slick movie trailers and boring MCs.
Corporate and soulless.
Exactly. Mm. But what they revere about the old E3 is so strange. They miss the chaotic days where you had nervous developers, often speaking English as a second language, standing on a live stage, sweating under the glaring lights.
Yeah.
They loved when these developers tried to show off live playable demos, which, by the way, the users openly acknowledged were sometimes blatantly faked.
But see, they preferred the faked live demos to a pre-rendered, perfect modern trailer.
Why, though?
Because the fake demo represented a human struggle. It was a group of people desperately trying to push limited technology, failing in real time and trying to hold it together. It was messy, and therefore, it was authentic. A slick, modern trailer feels like a corporate lie handed down from on high.
And that desire for the messy, the punishing, and the broken extends right into how they actually play games. They obsess over notoriously difficult mechanics from older titles.
Like the Shin Megami Tensei debate.
Yes. There is a whole debate in the text about the Minotaur boss fight in Shin Megami Tensei IV. One user is raging that it's purely RNG yarn ball, meaning it relies entirely on random number generation, just pure luck.
Right.
And it will one-shot kill you unless you use highly specific monsters like Jack Frost or an Oni with physical resistance.
And, you know, in modern game design, that would be considered a flaw.
Definitely.
Modern games are designed to adapt to ensure the player doesn't get too frustrated and quit. These users don't see that as bad game design. It becomes a badge of honor. It's a shared cultural touchstone of suffering.
My favorite example of this in the text is the guy playing Fallout 2.
Oh, yeah.
He hits a literal game-breaking bug at 80% completion. So he goes online, downloads a fan-made patch to fix it, which then corrupts his entire save file.
Yeah.
Everything is gone.
Gets wiped out.
And what does he do? He just starts the game completely over from scratch, explicitly stating he'd rather do that than play a modern Bethesda title.
It's the pursuit of systems they can master, even if those systems are fundamentally broken.
I look at that Fallout 2 example, and it reminds me of someone who owns an old, beat-up, classic car. The kind of car that breaks down every 3 miles.
Right.
And they love it because they have to get out on the side of the road, open the hood, and fix it themselves. The struggle is what creates the bond.
Yeah.
But I struggle to reconcile this. Why on earth do they revere the literal game-breaking bugs and corrupted save files of the 1990s as authentic, but they will mercilessly crucify a modern indie developer just because their character says I-I too many times?
It really comes down to the illusion of corporate control versus perceived vulnerability.
Okay.
A game-breaking bug from 1998 feels like an honest mistake by a group of nerds in a basement. It requires the player to engage, to find a patch, to solve the problem. The player has agency.
Right, they're fixing the car.
Exactly. But a modern indie game with polished, repetitive dialogue feels engineered. It feels like a product designed to manipulate their emotions. They don't want to be manipulated by an artist. They want to engage with a flawed, indifferent mechanical system that they can eventually conquer.
They are completely hypervigilant against being manipulated. Mm. And as we move through the source material, you see that vigilance violently bleed over into their real-world worldview.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this obsession with authenticity and hidden manipulation turns every single piece of pop culture into a proxy battle for political paranoia.
Now, just looking at this objectively as a sociological artifact, because obviously we are not sitting here validating these wild conspiracy theories, nor are we endorsing any political side here.
Right. We are strictly impartially reporting on the text to understand the behavior.
Right. But it is incredibly fascinating to see how they use deeply offensive alt-right internet slang to build a cohesive paranoid worldview out of standard media tropes.
The way they deconstruct narrative tropes is wild. The text features this massive deep dive into the trope of the rebel you learn is justified but uses the wrong methods.
Oh, right.
You know, the classic storyline where the villain actually has a really good point about society being broken, but then they blow up a building, so the hero has no choice but to stop them.
And one poster argues that this specific narrative trope is inherently hypocritical.
Yeah.
They claim it implicitly glorifies terrorism by admitting the system is fundamentally broken and needs changing, but ultimately it sides with the status quo by ensuring the rebel is punished by the rule of law.
They see the writing as a cowardly way for authors to acknowledge societal decay without actually having to advocate for real reform.
Exactly. Because this specific subculture feels utterly failed by the modern status quo, they take it personally when a piece of media introduces a character who wants to tear down the system, only to have the narrative punish that character to restore order.
They view it as narrative propaganda designed to keep people compliant.
Yes.
And they apply this hyper-political lens to everything.
Yeah.
There's this bizarre debate over whether it's lazy writing to base fictional villains on real politicians. Mm. Specifically, Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
They cite Dick Richardson from Fallout 2 and the literal preserved head of Richard Nixon in Futurama. They frame this as a classic liberal leftist writing tradition.
Right.
They argue that boomer era writers are just working through their own historical political trauma by constantly reviving Nixon as a villain, completely alienating younger audiences who just don't care about the 1970s.
And from analyzing those media tropes, the thread just spontaneously combusts into raw, unfiltered geopolitical rants.
All right.
There is no boundary between a video game critique and a global conspiracy.
In one breath, they are randomly debating Ireland's hypocrisy in exporting aluminum to Russia despite European Union sanctions. Mm-hmm. And in the next breath, they are railing against Gen Z for complaining that they can't afford homes while still buying expensive coffee.
And then they pivot directly into complaining about woke localizations in Japanese games.
Right. They start throwing around these incredibly loaded alt-right buzzwords like DEI brain and getting into deep paranoid conspiracies about global homo and global elites manipulating society.
We really need to unpack how those terms function for these users. Words like DEI brain or global homo act as blanket linguistic weapons.
How so?
They use them to dismiss anything they feel alienated by. Instead of grappling with complex socioeconomic shifts or evolving cultural norms that might make them feel left behind, they reduce all of modern society into a cartoonish, centralized conspiracy.
Wow.
It is a continuous search for the invisible hand that is holding them down.
Which leads to one of the most striking quotes in the entire source text. One user, while analyzing the IndieArt game scene, writes, "Wealth is the real opium of the masses."
Yeah, they use that phrase to critique why rich people feel emboldened to create bad art. They argue that wealth insulates these creators from reality, giving them unearned social capital and the delusion of artistic integrity.
But wait, are we seriously supposed to believe an anonymous image board poster is doing high-level Marxist theory here?
Well,
because to me, throwing around phrases like opium of the masses to critique an indie game just sounds like a really pretentious way of saying, I'm jealous of this successful developer and I'm mad that people like their game.
You've hit on the core tension of the entire board right there. They are absolutely using the vocabulary of sociological critique as a weapon to mask personal envy.
Oh, interesting.
By framing their personal distaste for a game as a structural, systemic failure of society, they elevate their own complaints. It's no longer just, I didn't like this game and I feel inadequate compared to the creator. It becomes, this game is a symptom of late-stage capitalist decay, and I am the only one intellectually gifted enough to see the truth. It is a massive defense mechanism.
When you recognize that it's a defense mechanism, you find the skeleton key to this entire deep dive. Because if we peel back the harsh indie game critiques, and we peel back the E3 nostalgia, and we look past the incredibly toxic political paranoia, what are we actually left with?
We are left with a startling, unfiltered portrait of the human beings actually sitting at their keyboards in the dark writing these posts.
Yeah.
When you strip away the abrasive noise, you find an incredibly deep void.
It is so jarring to read. Amidst all the vitriol and the geopolitical posturing, you suddenly hit these moments of striking, almost uncomfortable vulnerability.
Very uncomfortable.
One user just starkly confesses to the anonymous void, and I'm quoting directly here, "I think I realized what role image boards play in my life. When I'm too depressed to even zone out to YouTube videos, I just shitpost, close tab, do something else, reopen tab, repeat."
It's a mechanical rhythm of despair. They are describing a state of anhedonia where even passive entertainment, like a video, requires too much mental energy.
Yeah.
The only thing left is the reflexive twitch of refreshing an anonymous feed.
Another user chimes in, admitting to feeling entirely listless. They write, "I really don't know what to do with myself. I've got that listless urge to wander outside, perhaps get completely wasted."
And this underlying depression explains so much of how they consume media and why they hold on so tightly to fictional narratives.
Right, the text reveals this deep, self-described, maladaptive habit of treating fictional characters as if they're actually live.
Yes.
They write these massive, multi-paragraph essays dissecting the character arcs of figures from the webcomic Woodstock, specifically focusing on characters named Dave and Vriska.
What's crucial to understand here is why they attach to these specific fictional characters. They openly admit in the text that their intense attachments aren't born out of joy or admiration. They are born out of pity.
Pity.
Yeah, they describe feeling a shared sense of metatextual indignity.
Let's break down metatextual indignity for a second, because that phrase is so revealing.
It means they feel sorry for a character, not because of the tragic events that happen within the story, but because they believe the author wrote the character poorly.
Oh, wow.
They project their own feelings of being written poorly by the universe onto the character. They feel mistreated by society, so they deeply bond with a fictional character they believe was mistreated by their creator.
But this brings up the massive contradiction that I just can't shake. We're reading a thread full of people who have what they call chest brain.
Right.
They are hyper-literate. They are fully capable of writing 500-word collegiate-level essays on narrative structure, metatextual theory, or the nuances of geopolitical economics.
Yeah.
They are incredibly, undeniably smart.
Yes, they are.
Yet right in the middle of all that intellectual firepower, one user openly admits, "I don't have much of an identity anyway."
It's a tragedy of isolation. They have massive intellectual processing power, but nowhere to apply it in the real world and no one to share it with.
So is the aggressive, hyper-intellectual posturing of the image board actually just a protective shell? Like, are we essentially looking at people who are profoundly lonely and they are seeking literally any form of connection, even if the only way they know how to connect is by being deeply combative?
That is the most important insight of our deep dive. The hostility is the feature, not a bug. of their connection. In a space where showing genuine emotion or vulnerability is instantly mocked as weakness, shared hatred and shared hyperanalysis become the only safe ways to bond. They are building a community out of barbed wire.
Wow.
The chess brain essays, the political rants, the surgical game critiques, it's all a highly sophisticated mechanism to feel seen, validated, and respected by their peers without ever having to take the terrifying risk of saying, I am lonely and I need a friend.
When you look at it that way, it changes everything about how you read this text. So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Let's bring this all together.
Well, we started by looking at a wall of chaotic internet noise. We saw users microscopically nitpicking the 10-year development cycle of an indie game, tearing down dialogue and mechanics because they felt manipulated.
Right.
We traced that resistance to a powerful nostalgia, a mourning for the clumsy, messy authenticity of the old E3 days and broken 90s games, because those were systems they could master.
Yeah.
We then saw how that demand for authenticity fuels deep political paranoia, turning pop culture into a proxy war for real-world anxieties. But beneath it all, hiding behind the anonymous usernames and the intellectual posturing, we uncovered profound depression, listlessness, and isolation.
It shows how these raw, unfiltered, anonymous spaces aren't just separate from the real world. They aren't just a quirky internet subculture. They act as a distorted mirror for society's broader struggles.
Absolutely.
It's a reflection of how we consume modern media, how we project our insecurities onto art, and how deeply isolated people feel within modern society.
The image board is just the extreme edge of a much wider cultural phenomenon. It is essentially the canary in the coal mine for the modern internet.
Which brings us back to where we started today. Remember that pristine museum, the one where everything makes sense before we climb down into the chaotic sewer of human thought?
Yeah.
Well, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you go about your day. If the internet's absolute most abrasive, hypercritical, and anonymously toxic spaces are ultimately just a desperate coping mechanism for people who are profoundly lonely and depressed, how much of our mainstream cultural discourse is the exact same thing?
That's a great question.
When you look at the everyday arguments happening on your standard public social media feeds with real names and real faces attached, how much of that daily outrage is secretly driven by that exact same desperate urge to just fill the void?
It really makes you look at every single argument on the internet a little differently, doesn't it?
It really does. Until next time.